From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, making the case for doing nothing. And by nothing, the artist and writer Jenny O'Dell means wandering and walking. And this is not easy, she knows. It makes people feel unproductive. But in a new book, she's encouraging people to spend less time worrying about productivity and more time fully immersed in the moment. She'll join us to talk about what it might take to resist what she calls the attention economy. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The title of Jenny O'Dell's new book is straightforward enough, How to Do Nothing. But what does that mean, nothing? Well, here's a clue. She describes the book as less a lecture than an invitation to take a walk. So nothing is where you immerse yourself in the moment. You look at things. You notice stuff. You let it take your mind wherever it does. Nothing. But she also makes it clear she's not just thinking about this as an invitation to slow down or take the weekend off. It's more than that. The point of nothing, she says in the book, isn't to return to work refreshed, ready to be productive. In fact, she says she wants people to actually question what it means to be productive, what it means to be useful. Her idea is about resistance, resisting what she calls the attention economy, where you have companies with these financial incentives to keep people in a constant state of envy and distraction. So what she does in the book is try to get people to reroute their attention away from meaningless crap and arguments and to replant it to the here and now. The book is How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. Jenny O'Dell teaches at Stanford University. She joined us from a studio on the campus of Stanford in Palo Alto. I guess I wanted to begin with this. Why? Because you say this a few times in the book, doing nothing is hard. Why? Like, just essentially, why do you think doing nothing is so hard?
I think, you know, it's a lot of different reasons. Some of it's probably on the individual level and some of it's cultural. I think probably the part that I'm talking about the most in the book is the cultural part, where we've sort of grown up with this idea that it is, it's expected that you have something to show for your time, that it's sort of immoral to waste time. And that goes all the way back to, you know, like Puritanism.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's this, you know, long history of kind of like coming up in this culture that prizes results and goals and just kind of striving. And so I think like that's kind of the deepest level. Mm. Like if you work really hard to kind of try to get around it, like you're still going to run up against that.
Seems like the cultural part is the part that really concerns you. I mean, you talk about how, you say in the book, art doesn't really survive very well in a system that values only the bottom line.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that tension myself as a practicing artist and also someone who teaches art at a place like Stanford, where a lot of my students are engineering and product design students. You know, like trying to argue for, you know, the quote-unquote value, which I hate even using that word, of something like art, where it's very open-ended, it's not super obvious, it doesn't seem to achieve anything in the hyper-obvious way that other things might, and often doesn't appear innovative. You know, like, I've been in a position for almost 6 years of like, being the artist that argues for that. So I'm well aware of the pressures of kind of, I don't want to say it's always obviousness, but there does seem to be this kind of prizing of visible results and things that you can point to that have been produced.
Yeah.
It seems like people who write about mindfulness and trying to disconnect always have to have this disclaimer where they say, I'm not anti-technology. And you do that too in the book. You're like, I'm not anti-technology. So talk a little bit about that, because there is a part of technology that troubles you. And it's the sort of the commercial part of that. Explain that, if you would.
I think, you know, it's always helpful to keep in mind what technology is. It's, you know, I live in Silicon Valley, or I live near it, I guess. I grew up in it. And so it's really easy to kind of point the finger. But when you really think about it, right, like, you know, I'm a bird watcher. Binoculars are a form of technology. They are aiding human vision in a way that's sort of like unnatural, right? Some of the other examples that I give in the book are the app iNaturalist, which lets you take pictures of plants. And then it basically gives you a pretty good guess of what they are. Also works on animals if you're lucky enough to get a photo of one of those. So these are all, you know, I've tried to rack up examples, especially for my students, of uses and forms of technology that actually give you more access, especially to the physical world that you're in, but also things like historical context and, you know, just opening up the world more to you to show you something that you weren't seeing. So that's something that's always been amazing about technology, and I've loved that ever since I was, you know, a child. But then, yeah, you have the other end of that, which is like technology that is specifically designed to capture and hold your attention and keep it away, actually, from those things that are around you. So, like, I think I even have a slide in one of my lectures where I contrast someone using one of those constellation identifying apps where you can sort of point it at the sky and see what you're looking at, you know, that versus a bunch of people playing Candy Crush on the Muni on their phones, right? Like, this is the same technology. I mean, it's a phone, right? But one is asking you to kind of look outward and it's giving you information. The other one is it's helping you ignore all of that other information. And it's also encouraging a kind of shallow attention span.
This is what you say about the current system. You said that there's this impatience with anything nuanced, poetic, or less than obvious. Explain what you mean. This, what do you see as that resistance to nuance or the abstract? What is that? Do you think you understand it?
I think I understand some of it. I mean, it's something that I still think about a lot, and I think it honestly has a lot to do with time and patience.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the kind of ongoing themes in the book, and something that I'm actually continuing to research now, kind of more in depth, is this assumption that time is money. Mm. Of course, you know, if you really think about it, it's like time is not money, but we all are subject to a system in which time is money. So it doesn't even really matter at the end of the day, right, if whether you think time is money. And so if time is money and nuance and subtlety and complex problems take time, not only for an individual to reflect on them, but also for groups of people to have nuanced conversations. I mean, I give the example later on in the book of someone I was in an artist residency with who was, you know, from the Midwest and Catholic, very religious, and I'm not. And we would have really long kind of like just wandering conversations. We would sit on the roof of this place that we were staying in and look at the stars. And neither one of us ever convinced the other of our viewpoints, but we had way more nuanced understandings of where the other person was coming from. And we had a kind of mutual respect about it. And that was something that evolved like over many conversations. So like, you know, I think we all know that things like that are required, especially for problems that are not black and white.
Yeah.
And so if that takes time and yet time is money, that becomes very expensive. And so from like a ruthless capitalist framework, nuance and subtlety and ambiguity kind of just become, you know, almost like luxury goods or something. I don't know. They're too expensive.
Yeah. Now, we should get this out of the way. Explain what you mean by nothing. Because you're not saying nothing means disengage from everything. In fact, in some ways, it's like by doing nothing, it's a different kind of actual engagement, maybe.
Right, totally. So nothing for me, I mean, it's obviously not nothing, but I do think it's kind of important that it carries this connotation of emptiness or absence, because I think a lot of the book for me came out of this feeling of too much, right? There's too much all the time. There's too much information. There's too many people having too many, you know, making too many expressions. There's just kind of too much to be able to make sense of anything. And so I think in a situation like that, something like absence and emptiness becomes you know, quite crucial. You know, I think there are two, I mean, there's more than two, but there's two kind of main stances that you can find yourself in. One is the kind of reactive, kind of knee-jerk, hot take kind of mindset where, and I think that goes hand in hand with habitualness. Like, you know, this is, I would say, like, you're walking to work and you've walked the same route every day and you kind of always look at the same things. And so maybe there's some building there that if you brought your friend with you, they'd say like, hey, did you know that's this amazing historical building or something? But you're not. So this first kind of way of being is the one where you're not. You're just kind of like in a narrow state of mind, yeah. And you're reacting, not being super reflective about that. And then the second one, which is really kind of what I mean by nothing, is the opposite of that. So it's kind of being open to whatever is in front of you, being willing to be surprised, also being willing to be proven wrong, and just kind of being quiet enough in your mind to even be able to start to really actually see what's in front of you. Because, you know, honestly, I'm still surprised by what is in front of me in moments like that when I kind of like snap myself out of it and I just kind of stop and look at what and who is around me. And very frequently I'm humbled and surprised.
Yeah. I was really taken by how important the idea of place is in all of this, because you write about this distinction that you make between, you know, quote unquote, escaping the world and remaining in place while escaping a framework of this attention system. So talk a little bit about place and being rooted, because that seems like an important part of all of this.
Right. Yeah, it is. And I should say that I think, you know, this is something that anyone can do anywhere that they are, you know, even if they just moved there. I don't, you know, want to like privilege the experience of like having been somewhere forever.
Yeah.
It just, you know, it so happens that I have not moved very far from where I grew up. I grew up in Cupertino. Mm. If anything, I actually had a more humbling experience of finally learning about the ecology of where I live, which is a lot of what I talk about in the book, because, you know, these are things that were right in front of me for my entire life. I'm very surprised to find out, you know, what these things are. But I think I just was surprised, you know, like we use words like grounding, right? Like I want to feel grounded. And I ended up, you know, in my own experience being surprised by how literal that can be, like that actually just the ground of the place that I'm in is grounding, just like some kind of knowledge and context around, you know, what is my bioregion? What are the local mountain ranges, watersheds? You know, who first lived here? What is the history of this place? You know, and very quickly you realize that it's, you know, it's not as arbitrary as you think. Like, yeah. To give a kind of weird example, I grew up in Cupertino. Anyone who's been there knows that it's pretty, you know, it's a sprawl. Mm. It's not, in terms of like urban design, the most inspiring place to be. And I and a lot of other, you know, people that I grew up with would always complain about how Cupertino is so boring, it's so flat, it has no downtown, it's so weird, you know. And then, you know, just this past year, I did this whole research project on a creek that goes through Cupertino, which I also talk about in the book. Yeah. And in that research, it's like I found out that there are very specific reasons for all of these things. Like there is a reason there isn't a downtown that has to do with a group of people that made specific decisions, you know, finding out, like, you know, what things were actually named after. These are real people, you know, and it really like it completely changes your perception of a place. Like you no longer feel like you're kind of floating unattached, you know, through this endless present, but you actually feel like you're standing on something. And I find that kind of grounding effect is incidentally a great antidote to something like the attention economy.
It's interesting, growing up as you did in the, I'm just thinking of the wider, you know, Bay Area of San Francisco, and you mentioned this, that there are these sort of two conflicting things going on there. There's a ton of technology companies and there's a lot of really beautiful nature there. So what was your own experience like? Were you sort of bouncing back and forth between those two? I think you mentioned you went sort of from computer to nature, computer to nature. So you had to deal with both of those things, I guess.
Yeah, I definitely grew up kind of between those two. And a lot of that has to do with my parents, too, because they both worked for kind of not startups, because I didn't really have startups as we know them back then, but just kind of big technology companies. But they were both also very into the outdoors. So Yeah, I mentioned in the book, like, I went to my mom's work, which was Hewlett Packard, and when I was very young, put on, I think, what the, you know, it's the equivalent of a VR headset.
Right.
And then, you know, would otherwise be at, like, summer camp in the Santa Cruz Mountains. So,
yeah.
And my dad even had in our garage, like, the kind of, like, prototypical, like, tinkerer's garage, you know, like, when you see, like, images of Silicon Valley, and there's always, like, some inventor in their garage.
Yeah.
So I definitely kind of grew up in the middle of all that. And so I think, you know, maybe it's unsurprising that a lot of my work as an artist, and I kind of continued this interest in the writing, is how to use technology to have more access to the physical world, like, yeah, in a way that kind of makes sense as the outcome of those two things.
Let's talk about the experience that brought you to start writing about this. You mentioned how after Donald Trump was inaugurated that you, as an artist, you say you found it difficult, and fellow artists were feeling the same way, finding it difficult to continue making anything at all. And you also mentioned that there was this point when you couldn't really make sense of anything. And so you went to this public rose garden in Oakland. It's not far from where you live. Talk a little bit about this, because this is where you really start thinking deeply about this.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, in the kind of run up to all of that, as I've already mentioned, I had long kind of been in a position of kind of advocating for, you know, ambiguity and subtlety and the value of art. I am someone who is, you know, frequently like the artist that gets invited to the tech conference. So so I think that was kind of an important background that was kind of, you know, maybe in the back of my mind throughout all of this. And then just observing myself, you know, that I had this kind of instinctual reaction to go sit in this rose garden fairly often. I mean, I live, you know, about 5 or 10 minutes away. I still go there all the time. I know all the gardeners now. And all the different animals that live there. But I found that I was just going there and sitting and not really doing anything. And in kind of observing myself doing that, I kind of started to wonder why this is a reaction to a moment like that. And I also kind of started to look around at this rose garden. And there are aspects of the rose garden that started to become really important metaphors for me and in thinking about what is important about this kind of figure of doing nothing. And so there's, you know, this rose garden is kind of atypical the way that it was designed. It was built in the 1930s, but it's very, it has a labyrinth-like quality to it. It's very much not the kind of like rose, you know, straight rows of roses. It has different sections. It's kind of built into a hill. It's pretty big, and so it's kind of a place where you could really, I mean, I know this because I have done this, you could spend an entire day there. Mm-hmm. You could sit in a bunch of different places, and you see so many different types of people there just using it for all different kinds of things, you know, just it's just really lovely to see this kind of public space where no one is a customer. It's just this kind of open space where you're allowed to wander and kind of do whatever it is that you want to do. And so I kind of tied this importance of doing nothing and listening and observing and the importance of that for just reflection and thinking with the public spaces where we're allowed to do that. I think those are the kind of spatial underpinnings of an activity like that. And then it also gave me the opportunity to also think about things like care and maintenance and about how these things are also kind of, you know, undervalued, especially compared to something like, you know, innovation and more obvious forms of productivity. That there, you know, one of the artists that I talk about, Mierle Lederman-Ukeles, wrote something called the Maintenance Manifesto in 1969. And it's, you know, written from the point of view of an artist who's also become a mother, and about the immense amount of work and repetitive tasks that a mother has to do, and that these are not recognized as work. And so that says a lot about how care and maintenance are undervalued, because for a long time they were done for free and they were somewhat invisible. Mm. And so to me, that's also tied to this idea of doing nothing, that some of it, I kind of hate the term self-care because it's been appropriated in a lot of ways by various brands, but it is, you know, an important act of maintenance for the self and also for communities to just kind of remember that this space for reflection and conviviality are absolutely necessary, just as necessary as anything else.
One of the things you write about is the importance of context, how context is what happens. Basically, when you pay attention enough. And one of the things you write about is bird watching or bird noticing, as you've called it, which is a really good example. And over time, you mention in the book how it wasn't just birds you were paying attention to. It was the things connected to the birds that you were also paying attention to, the places where you could find them and the things that they ate. And, you know, birds, bugs, trees, as you say. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't really tease them out eventually. And this is the, I guess, and then that context also included you and your part in this. Talk a little bit about the importance of context in the scheme of things.
Yeah, you put it really well. It's sort of context is, you know, it's something that naturally occurs, you know, as you pay more and more attention. And I find that there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. I think, yeah. Perceptually speaking, like there's a lot there around everything. And in, you know, learning my local birds, I very quickly learned that if you want to know what you're looking at, you need to know what time of year it is. You need to know where you are. Yeah, it really helps to know what kind of tree, you know, it is. Like all of these kind of contextual factors. These are also the factors that make something like iNaturalist, the app that I mentioned, these are the things that make it work. Mm-hmm. Because if you are in a place and you take a photo of, say, like a yellow bird, of course there are lots of yellow birds that exist, but there are only so many yellow birds that might be in the place where you are at that time. So it just goes to show the kind of importance for context in terms of understanding what you're looking at. And I think that's something that anyone who has studied either ecology or history has a really good appreciation of, that it's actually quite hard to pluck something out in isolation, whether that's an event or an organism or a part of an ecosystem. Like everything is very much influenced by other things. And that kind of comes back again to that. It's not ambiguous, but it is something that takes patience to understand something like that. And so, you know, towards the end of the book, I talk about how it's a problem for information that we receive and consume online if it's lacking temporal and spatial context. You know, if it's true that we need this kind of when, where, and why around something to be able to understand it, you kind of start to notice that a lot of that is missing, especially on something, you know, for example, like Twitter, where you're getting little bits of information completely, you know, devoid of the things that kind of come around that, right? Like, yeah. You know, who is saying this, why, in what context, like, what is the history of this? And something that I'm personally really concerned about is, just in the few projects that I've done and also in this book, the historical research that I've done, you know, I'm not a historian. I'm curious. So I get, you know, I end up digging up a lot of details, but in this kind of small amount of historical research that I've done, I am just amazed at how much there is that has happened not even that long ago that is, so directly relevant to what is happening right now.
Yeah.
Not in some sort of like analogy or like metaphorical way, but like directly, you know, has a direct bearing on what is happening right now. And I find that kind of layer of history is so buried underneath this kind of constant amnesiac present that this kind of attention economy encourages. So I think that in that kind of situation, like any kind of ability to just stop and ask for context or want to look for it kind of becomes a survival skill.
Jenny O'Dell. Her new book is How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER is a family, so let's stay in touch. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and we'll keep you in the know about breaking news happening in Utah. We'll invite you to films and parties, and you'll even see funny pictures of us sometimes. Best of all, we'll get to hear from you. Tell us what you care about in your community, and get to know your fellow public radio nerds. Follow KUER on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the artist and writer Jenny O'Dell is making the case for doing nothing. And she knows this isn't easy. She knows it makes people feel lazy and unproductive. But in a new book, she's encouraging people to spend less time worrying about productivity and more time fully immersed in the moment. Her book is called How to Do Nothing. One of the things you write about is this process of when people are removed from something. And this happened to your father, but you also mentioned John Muir, how he had this experience. He nearly lost his sight, and it really changed the way his perception. I mean, he already had a strong perception of the world, I suppose, but it really made him rethink his priorities. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about this process of removal and include your father in this, if you would.
Yeah, so my dad, before I was born, he was basically a technician in the Bay Area and had gotten, you know, super fed up with his job and decided to quit and live just very cheaply for a while. I don't think that he planned for that to be 2 years, but it ended up being 2 years. And I asked him about that time and what he did, and he said that he played the flute in the hills, just like so like idyllic. And then, you know, he was still working on kind of math, like electronic stuff, had a lot of long conversations with his roommate. You know, in that time, he kind of learned that time is a really important ingredient in, you know, coming up with ideas, but also just like getting some perspective. So he kind of realized in that time that a lot of what was upsetting to him about his job actually had more to do with him than anything else. And he ended up going back to the same company, but with kind of a different attitude, and actually ended up, you know, having a bunch of patents and inventing things and kind of moved up the ranks. But I don't think that's the point. I think the point you know, that like it kind of takes a pause and some kind of removal to get perspective on the thing that you were just embroiled in, particularly if it's something that I think you have a lot of, you know, like emotions about or anxiety. I mean, it's really, really easy to forget. I forget all the time. I just spent, you know, a month, you know, doing a lot of book publicity, honestly, and I didn't go on the kind of long walks that I'm very accustomed to, and then started to feel miserable, and then was like, you know, attributing my misery to all kinds of interesting things. And then just 2 days ago, I took my design class on our typical field trip, which is an open space preserve here in Palo Alto. And after they all left because they had to go to their next classes, I just kept walking. And after about 2 or 3 hours, was like, wow, I just feel like I can think again. Like, I feel like there are thoughts that I've been trying to have for a month and that I have somehow completed my brain and I can now, like, have these thoughts. And it's just so funny because it's literally what I'm saying in the book. That you just need to pull yourself out, even just, you know, for however long you can get away with, that there are certain types of perspective and reflection that you're just not going to be able to get otherwise.
Well, one of the things you make clear, and we should, in as you do in the book, is that this is not about just taking a break and coming back to work ready to be productive. What you're questioning is what we've come to see as the idea of what it means to be productive. That's the thing you want people to do when they disconnect is I guess what? Rethink this idea of what it means to be useful and productive.
Right. Yeah. I'm very much arguing against a kind of narrow definition of optimization. We live in a culture that also kind of prizes goal-oriented kind of increased performance, right? Like as if you or your life is a product that can be kind of streamlined and made to kind of give you better returns. Yeah. And so implicit in that is this idea that there is like a kind of point in space that you are kind of guiding yourself toward. And anything, you know, anything in your life that doesn't help you achieve that goal is sort of like beside the point, which is a really, I think that's probably been true for a long time. But now you have, you know, algorithms recommending things to you based on these things. So it's like super streamlined and very much a risk that you would not encounter these kind of things around you that might surprise you or change you. Yeah, the point is not to, you know, like, it's not some form of conditioning, right? It's not like, it's not like mindfulness as life hack, which we certainly have a lot of around here.
Yeah.
It's more sort of like, oh, wait, like, was I even, all of this, like, you know, constant striving, like, was that even in the right direction? Or what is, you know, what does even mean? What does this striving mean? You know, at the very beginning of the book, I talk about the Taoist story of the useless tree, which is just like you know, that that proves that, you know, people had a sense of humor about this a really long time ago.
Right.
But, you know, it's basically the story of a carpenter who sees a huge gnarled tree and kind of disdainfully says, like, it only got that big because it's useless for timber, because he can only see trees as timber. And then he goes to sleep and the tree comes to him in a dream and basically makes fun of him and says, well, how do you know what usefulness is? And you're a mortal man. You're about to die. You know, yeah. Meanwhile, uselessness has been very useful for me because I've grown to this size. So it's a really, you know, the punchline of that story is like, it's really perspective. It's like, you know, you can be productive, but if you zoom out from that, it's like, productive of what and why and for whom? Yeah. And these are questions I think you risk not asking if you kind of stay in that short loop.
Let's talk about some of the people who've tried to do nothing, because you have a section about some who've tried. And in some cases it works, in some cases it doesn't. I mean, and there are lessons from all of this. But I wanted to begin with, you mentioned this story, I think it was last summer, you went on this trip to, you went to a cabin in the Sierra Nevadas, and it was pretty isolated. You didn't have any cell reception. You didn't have any Wi-Fi. And you say it surprised you to find out how quickly you stopped caring. Will you say something about that experience? What is it? Just talk about what it was like to be actually literally disconnected.
I mean, it was surprising in both kind of that I was surprised by how much it initially freaked me out.
Yeah.
To be in this space. And I think it matters, you know, that I was alone and I was in this kind of very small town where I had just arrived and I don't really, you know, have my bearings. But yeah, so I spent a little while just kind of, you know, feeling hapless and very much thinking about it. And then, I want to say after about like maybe half an hour, I just kind of accepted it. And then a little while later, I felt relief. Yeah. And I was there for a couple of days. So I remember just kind of looking over at my phone and it was just this object. Like, it felt very inert. It wasn't connected to anything. And it was only useful to me as a flashlight and a timer.
Right.
Those are the only times I used it. And you know, I talk about how it was, you know, obviously easier for me to get work done. And it was a relief. But that at the same time, even in that moment, as I was aware of how nice it was, I was also aware that, you know, the answer is not to move to this cabin and not right. be connected to anybody, that, you know, practically speaking, for a lot of us, we have to return. And then, you know, what I end up talking about later in the chapter is morally speaking, you also have to return.
Right.
Like, you also have to turn your attention back to that thing you were kind of trying to disentangle yourself from. So it becomes this kind of complicated dance of removing oneself enough, you know, occasionally here and there, or even just in the moment with one's attention, to have that perspective mm-hmm. and to be able to think, but then also, you know, be participating, obviously.
There are a number of these experiments that people tried in the 1960s and early 70s that interest you. I wanted to talk about a few of these, but first explain why you find those instructive, those experiments.
In general, I think I have an interest in history, in terms of like, I love to see, you know, okay, what did people do the last time this happened?
Yeah,
maybe
right.
not the last time this happened, but what, you know, one other time that this happened.
Yeah,
For me, just, you know, because I grew up in the Bay Area, I've been very aware of the kind of 1960s communes. Mm-hmm. Although I also talk about the Garden of Epicurus
right.
in that chapter. So it really goes, you know, way back. And, you know, obviously there have been many, many, many such movements over history. But I was interested in looking at that one just because, you know, yeah, it made such a big kind of stamp on where I live. And I had sort of read things about them here and there. And I was really just curious to look into the details of the kinds of problems, you know, first of all, the impulse mm-hmm. that drove them out there, which was in a way somewhat similar.
Yeah.
Wanting to kind of like escape politics and media and kind of seeing everything as very corrupt and wanting to start fresh and build something that felt more meaningful, oftentimes in, you know, more relationship with nature. But then, you know, the problems that they ran into where, you know, you can move to the middle of nowhere, but you still live in a capitalist, yeah. you know, country, and yeah. you still, like, there are bills to be paid and children to be raised. And so there were, you know, all different kinds of ways of dealing with that. But the ones that interested me were the ones where if you're trying to escape politics and you move out into the middle of nowhere, because there's no such thing as an apolitical space,
yeah.
because you have a group of people living together, you you can't your replacement can't be nothing.
Right. Right.
And I think in places like that, you know, people were constantly coming and going, leaving, trying to find the place where they kind of just like vibed better with everyone. And so it becomes this irony of you actually have to reconstruct the basics of politics.
I was interested in how they were trying to sort of figure out a way to balance or find that balance between the individual and the group. That seemed to be something that was really complicated and difficult to do. And then you mentioned about those big questions that always came up in those experiments or seemed to be at the heart of them. And that is, you know, as you put it in your book, what responsibility do you have to the world that you left behind, if any? And what are you going to do out there?
Yeah, right. I don't think it's a coincidence that kind of individual versus the group problem was one of the biggest challenges, because you could argue that is still one of the biggest challenges of our entire government right now. Yeah. It's like, you know, this very uneasy tension between ceding some decisions and, you know, even some rights, right, to the greater good, and making an agreement and holding fast to that agreement, versus, you know, having like complete individual liberty, is like something that is very much like, oh, that problem is alive right now. Yeah. And so I think when you look at these communes, you kind of see that playing out in a really interesting microcosm that, I mean, like, you know, if you read the kind of firsthand accounts of people living in those, they're really intense. I mean, it sounds like a reality show. It's just, it's like all of those emotions in a very small space. So I do mention there that one of the things that I found most interesting about them, and maybe one of the reasons that they kind of have the legacy that they did, is that they, you know, they were out there, but they would often, you know, tour around and speak to, you know, people in cities or go to schools, and people would also visit them. A lot of them, it seemed to have suffered from some publicity, but, you know, I kind of make this point that even if some of them didn't succeed, they became valuable as kind of points of dialogue. So, you know, when they're sharing ideas about like a different way to live with people who are living, say, like in the suburbs or something, that's obviously, you know, an interesting and valuable thing. And one of the places where I think they maybe were successful.
The thing that is motivating your argument, you say early on, is a simple refusal. Explain what you mean. A refusal to what?
I think it's a little bit hard to articulate, but I think this has to do, again, with where I grew up. I'm very familiar with this kind of culture of innovation for the sake of innovation, you know, an obsession with newness, constantly needing to show, you know, like skyrocketing growth. And you have situations where, like, you know, we have startups who will, you know, put out a product or a service that seems, you know, suspiciously close to just what a bus is, right? Like, well, we have this big vehicle that will pick you up from your house and, you know, like, it's like,
right.
Okay, we
that's
have
a bus.
That.
Yeah, it's
a bus, and it's really underfunded right now, and it would be great if, like, we had better bus service. So I think I've just had this kind of long-standing annoyance with the kind of blank slate mentality of kind of like sweeping, imagining yourself to sort of sweep everything aside and building this kind of like hyper-designed replacement for it. It seems arrogant to me, and also just seems like a waste of energy. And so I have long had this kind of like deep feeling of wanting to kind of force an acknowledgement of what is already here, and who is already here and who has already been here. And the forms of, you know, quote unquote, productivity that are all around us that are not acknowledged, you know, these kind of systems of life and just all of the things that kind of can't be described in the black and white sort of capitalist terms, that this is something that I think we all obviously kind of want and need, these things just to have rewarding lives as like human beings. And so when the kind of simple refusal is like the simple refusal to kind of continue buying into the idea that the things that are around me and the people that are around me are not enough. There's something more that is needed, and it's kind of this forward propulsion, like we need to get to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And I'm kind of like, no, I don't want to go to the next thing. I want to stop right where I am and kind of look around at what's here. And you know, I talk about restoration, remediation, like just like acknowledgement and repair of everything that's already here.
You write about a few of these, but one memorable person who chose to refuse was Diogenes, philosopher from the 4th century Athens. He was kind of this radical, fascinating. Plato described him as Socrates gone mad. I mean, he really took it to the limit, his kind of, I'm not sure if he was a misanthrope, but you say he was kind of like a performance artist. And talk a little bit about him, because I think he's fascinating, because you say that he can teach us a lot about how to refuse.
Yeah, he's great. I feel like they should make a show about him.
Yeah.
I would watch it.
Yeah.
If you can imagine like Socrates as a performance artist, like that, it's actually kind of a good description of him, because he espoused a lot of the same ideas in terms of like questioning really kind of accepted cultural norms that he felt were, you know, hypocritical or just kind of arbitrary. But instead of, you know, kind of using the dialogue in the way that Socrates would, he would just kind of perform these things. Mm-hmm. And I describe it as being somewhat slapstick. So, for example, he lived in a barrel. It's sometimes referred to as a tub, the man who lived in a tub. And, you know, had very few possessions. And there's a story where everyone around him was preparing for some kind of battle. And so they were all kind of running around and trying to make themselves useful. And he started rolling his barrel up and down the hill very industriously. And someone asked him why. And he was like, oh, I'm just trying to, you know, be as productive as all of you are. You know, I'm just trying to fit in here. And he would, you know, frequently do things backwards or kind of upside down to, you know, kind of make this point that everything was backwards and upside down. And my other favorite story of him is when Alexander the Great came to visit him. And, you know, he's lying on the ground and he kind of walked over and was like, oh, I'm such a fan. Is there anything I can do for you? And Diogenes says, yeah, get out of my son.
Yeah.
it's this kind of these acts, right? Like they even now they give us like some kind of something to use, like an image to kind of help us think about refusal. But the really important, I think, aspect of him was that he, you know, if he was really refusing, right, like if he really couldn't live with that stuff,
yeah,
he would just leave, right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
he would. There were philosophers, you know, cynics who killed themselves because that was kind of their exit. And he didn't do either one of those things. He just stayed exactly where he was. And he felt that it was kind of his duty to, you know, produce these images and these acts.
Yeah, you call it this. He stayed in town, basically. You call it a third space, the third space.
Yeah, that it's this kind of not yes and not no. I mean, right after that, I talk about Bartleby,
yeah,
you know, the Melville short story where the character famously keeps saying, I would prefer not to. And I think that is just a really great, again, illustration of, you know, it's not yes, I will, and it's not no, I won't, because actually either one of those is accepting the terms of the question.
Right.
But saying something like, I would prefer not to, it's like, you know, the narrator of that story is like, what? What does that mean? You know, he's like, I just want you to like agree with me or disagree with me. But this is kind of like carving out this space like around the question.
Which means what to you? And how does that apply to those of us who are trying to do a better job at doing nothing? And that is just confront the situation on our own terms, I guess.
Yeah, I think for me, like linguistically, something like I would prefer not to, or even like the acts of Diogenes are in a way very related to kind of what I was saying about perspective. They are ways of stepping outside the yes or no question, stepping outside accepted modes of engagement, even accepted modes of refusal, right? Like looking for other modes of refusal or just refusing the question kind of altogether. And so it's this kind of like weird mind trick of seeing if there's a way that you can kind of, it's something that allows you to sit with something, but not completely submit to it,
yeah,
or to its terms.
Yeah.
And often to make kind of really, I think, closer observations of that thing.
You say in the book that you find you're looking at your phone a lot less these days. And it's not because you went through some big digital detox or that you have some app that helps you or that you've deleted a bunch. You say you stopped looking at your phone because you were looking at something else. Something, as you put it, that was so absorbing you couldn't turn away. Like that seemed really important to me, this idea that, oh, I just found something else to focus on.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is just because I am a person who is easily absorbed and a curious person, but I do think there is something maybe a little bit unreasonable about asking someone to stop paying attention to something without giving them something else to pay attention to,
yeah.
or at least a suggestion of a direction they could go in. I don't think there's anything, you know, wrong with the fact that that humans are, you know, always looking for the next thing to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. You know, like these are kind of natural things. We're curious and we like to, you know, look at new things. And so the question turns into like, okay, is there somewhere else where you can find those things, like something else that makes you curious, something else that makes you engaged? I find it very telling that even people who look at their phones, like, you know, who have like maybe like a phone addiction problem, if you ask them, you know, when is the time when you weren't looking at your phone, I would guess that for a lot of them, it would be in-person conversations with friends and family.
Yeah.
That's where you are being addressed very specifically and you're engaged and you're paying attention, right? So for me, that just like happens to be, you know, walking around outside. Mm. The more I kind of have learned about my local ecology, I've also just learned more about, you know, ecology in general and how plants work and animal behavior. And it's kind of like opened up into this whole universe that is almost like hopelessly interesting to me. Mm-hmm. Like it's actually, you know, you talk about distraction, like it actually distracts me from things that I'm, you know, quote unquote, supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just as absorbing to me. But for me, the difference between that kind of absorption and being absorbed, you know, with something on my phone is that every time I go outside and I'm kind of paying attention. And again, you know, I have to acknowledge that I am very privileged to live in a place like Oakland, which, you know, not only has great weather, but, you know, has like, you know, everyone has insane like gardens. Mm-hmm. And we have, you know, lots of parks. And I work at a place with a, you know, really beautiful campus. But you know, every time I go outside, I'm surprised. I'm surprised by something. You know, just 2 days ago, I saw two different species of birds for the first time in my entire life, which in bird watching is referred to as a lifer. Mm. And I was just totally flabbergasted. I almost like didn't even know what to do with myself. I was kind of useless.
Yeah.
I feel like when I go to my phone, I have my expectations confirmed.
Yeah.
But when I kind of exercise this curiosity outward, it's the opposite. And I end up being sort of disassembled where I kind of lose track of the boundaries of even myself after, you know, a couple hours. And I want to say, you know, sometimes I describe that as like therapeutic, but I think even that is a reductive understanding of what's actually happening.
Yeah. Well, you have this great way of summarizing all of this. In the book, you ask readers to imagine you going to this tech conference, and how it's, you know, it's great, it's important, and it's really interesting. But at some point, you leave and you go outside to get some fresh air. Maybe say something about that analogy, which I thought was really apt. Finally,
so you know, the tech conference that I imagine and that kind of thought experiment is kind of a stand-in for a lot of work that, you know, I want to say is important that's being done about addictive design of technology. Mm-hmm. and kind of trying to change the design of that and possibly regulate it. So that, you know, is that's that whole conversation that's happening, which I am very interested in, like, right, initially at the beginning of the story. But then it's the almost like the I would prefer not to moment where I wander outside of
yep.
the building.
Yep.
And actually, you know, not long after I finished the draft of the book, this actually happened to me. I did wander out of a tech conference and end up looking at a bunch of trees. But yeah, so I wander outside, I see a bird, I follow it, and then I realize that in order to look it up later, I'm going to have to look at how it behaves, I'm going to have to look at what kind of tree it's in. Then I'm going to start wondering about all the trees, then I'm going to start wondering about the park, then I will start to wonder, you know, what is even the general shape of the place that I am, because conferences are so often in another city. It's amazing to me that we can fly somewhere, you know, not even have a general sense of like where the mountains are and where the water is and
yeah.
just these kind of, until you like fly out right in the plane and you're looking back. But so yeah, I kind of end up asking all these questions, and these are really just questions about where and when I am and how I know that. And so I end up, you know, in the story, like doing this so long that I miss the entire conference. And so it appears to be a sort of delinquent activity, right?
Yeah.
But that is very much at the heart of kind of the critique that I'm making of productivity, where there's this other kind of plane that you can exist in that is not, it appears to others that you would be doing nothing, but actually you are being very present in your own life and, you know, you only get one of those. So
that's the artist and writer Jenny Odell. She teaches at Stanford University. Her book is How to Do Nothing: Resisting the Attention Economy. She joined us from a studio on the campus of Stanford in Palo Alto, California. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. And I should mention, this is our last show for a few months. I announced earlier this week we're taking a break for the summer to reflect and to refresh our ideas for the program. And the reaction has been nice. Most of you saying really kind things, wishing us well, looking forward to when we get back. And some of you have said you're a little worried about what this break will mean. And I get that. Change is hard for some of us, probably all of us. And I have to say, the only thing you should really be worrying about is that our longtime producer, Elaine Clark, is not going to be here when we return. I mean, she'll be in the building, just not working with Radio West anymore. Elaine is going to be the new managing editor in our newsroom, which is a decision for her that may not have been easy, but it makes a lot of sense. She has a lot of gifts to give to a place, and it was probably time to move on. Her commitment, her work ethic, her attention to detail, just her ability to find stuff, people and dates, other stuff too. I've asked her to track down some pretty weird things over the years. But she's really been the backbone to this show, and I am going to feel the loss, and you are too. So we wish her the best. And finally, thanks to you for listening all these years, and we'll talk to you soon. Have a great summer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.